United States v. Hardiman. Mr. Baldwin.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Jeff Baldwin. I represent Leslie Hardiman, who stands convicted of conspiracy and possession with intent to distribute crack cocaine. I will concede that I am not before the court from a position of strength in that the motions or the errors that we've raised have to be reviewed as plain error due to a lack of motion for judgment of acquittal at the close of the evidence and due to the failure to object to certain hearsay statements. However, I do believe that the effect of those errors, and they are plain, should entitle Mr. Hardiman to a new trial at the very least, if not a reversal and acquittal. With regard to the conspiracy count, the evidence that was presented is insufficient to prove a conspiracy. There was simply two people in a truck with no showing of any type of agreement between them. And with regard to the possession, Mr. Hardiman was never shown to possess anything, Mr. Leslie Hardiman. The evidence adduced at trial was that Mr. Willie Hardiman exited the vehicle and ran with a brown paper bag that later was shown to have cocaine. Without the statements of Detective Lewis, with regard to the statements made to him by Mr. Cherry, the informant in this case, there was not insufficient evidence to identify Leslie Hardiman as being a member of any conspiracy or possessing any cocaine with intent to distribute. The elicited testimony included identification of Mr. Hardiman, the referral to the arranged transaction that was purported to be occurring. Those type of statements, without Mr. Cherry testifying himself, I believe is plain error. And with that, judges, we would ask that the court reverse Mr. Hardiman's conviction.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Baldwin.
Thank you.
Ms. Cook?
May it please the court, Mr. Blackington. I represent Willie Hardiman. It's our position that even under a plain error standard, the evidence against Willie Hardiman was legally insufficient to sustain a conviction for conspiracy, which requires proof that the defendant knowingly joined in the conspiracy. The government cites in its brief four facts as supporting the verdict of guilty as respect to conspiracy, that being Willie Hardiman's presence at the scene of the car chase, his flight from law enforcement officers, his denial of guilt when he was arrested, and a telephone call that he made after his arrest. I'll deal with those just very briefly because I want to get on to what I believe is the more important point in this argument. The presence of Willie at the scene of the car chase was the result of a pre-planned period of time that he was going to spend with his brother, which had nothing whatsoever to do with the unanticipated telephone call that was received from Joe Cherry inviting this drug transaction to take place. The flight from law enforcement and the denial of guilt, I think, are not so unusual in any circumstance. My client was a transient homeless individual who was acquitted of the offense of possession with intent to deliver the crack cocaine that he was found fleeing from the car in possession of. The telephone conversation which he had...
Fleeing from the car in possession of?
The testimony at trial was that he jumped out of the car
right. And
fled, that he had a paper sack in his hand. He was acquitted of possession of the crack cocaine with intent to deliver.
But he was no question he had the crack cocaine.
The testimony was to that effect, yes.
No.
The telephone conversation which he had following his arrest and also following the end of the conspiracy was clearly at the initiation of his brother, Leslie Hardiman. He identified himself as Leslie in order to get the other party to accept the telephone call and indicated during that telephone conversation that he was conveying a message. What I believe put this evidence over the top for the jury with respect to the conspiracy count was the admission of the insufficiently redacted statement made by Leslie Hardiman that was introduced by the government. And that statement is attachment C on page 32 of the appendix. I believe that there are two statements in Mr. Hardiman's statement that ambiguous with respect to whom they reference, and that being a statement to the effect Leslie Hardiman stated that he intended to have someone else take over the cocaine business and that he was going to get back into the marijuana business. We could live with that statement. I think that is a reference to someone else. It's a neutral pronoun. It does not point definitely to Willie Hardiman. However, it's the last statement that unerringly, without question, identifies only Willie Hardiman. That's the statement where Leslie Hardiman stated that he intended to introduce someone else to Joe Cherry and inform Cherry that he would be dealing with the other individual during any further transaction involving cocaine.
Is it the phone call in which Willie Hardiman mentions Cherry that you regard as tying him to this someone?
No, I'm talking about Leslie Hardiman's statement.
I understand, but what is it that makes you say that that's an unequivocal reference to Willie?
The only two individuals who were in the vehicle are Leslie and Willie Hardiman. There were no other individuals other than Mr. Cherry.
The sentence you're complaining about says that stated he intended to introduce someone, and you say the someone is Willie.
Absolutely. No doubt that someone is Willie.
There's no basis for that other than the phone call in which he complains about Cherry having set him up.
No, Your Honor. He's telling, in this statement, he is saying he's going to inform Cherry. That's a statement about something he's going to do in the future. He's telling law enforcement officers it's his plan to introduce someone to Cherry in the future. And he goes on to say that Cherry is going to be dealing with that other individual during any further transaction involving cocaine. That means that Leslie is saying he's not going to be involved in any further.
What is it that ties this to Willie?
It's tied to Willie because there is no one else.
Where is there in the evidence something where Willie says something that makes you say that this is an unequivocal reference?
Willie doesn't say anything that makes it an unequivocal reference.
What does Leslie say that ties it to Willie? Why can't it be a third party?
Because there is no third party.
There is no third
who's
party there.
Him.
But he's talking about something in the future. He was going to do something in the future.
He's on his way to the transaction then, and he's saying, what he's saying in effect is, this is my last transaction.
Could he also pick up four people between there and drop Willie off twice? You know,
there was no evidence whatsoever to that effect, and in fact,
but we're talking about an unequivocal nailing Willie to this statement, and I said there are possible other interpretations of that statement other than what you described as unequivocal. It isn't.
He turned around after he had already arrived at the place where he was to meet Cherry,
right.
So he was not going to pick anyone else up and route. This was to be his last meeting with Cherry, and he was going to introduce someone else, and the only possible someone else is Willie, because he's the only other person there to be introduced. And what Leslie is telling the law enforcement officers is, this is my last meeting with Cherry. All the further transactions are going to be with someone else.
In this attachment C.
He would be dealing with the other individual during any further transaction.
No, I'm lost.
I think
that... Can you point to something in the evidence, not in attachment C, something in the elsewhere in the evidence which connects the someone to Willie?
It's not that there's something else in the evidence. It's the absolute absence of anything in the evidence that would connect it to anyone else.
The evidence that shows there's nobody else involved, isn't there?
Well, I don't know how I can prove the absence. There was no one else involved according to all the testimonies. There was no suggestion that anyone else may have been involved. There was no time for anyone else to have been involved. This transaction would have taken place. It would have been Leslie's last meeting with Cherry, but for the fact that the law enforcement officers appeared and deterred him. One other thing that I think is important...
I'm sorry, but I don't understand you. You're not making yourself clear.
All right.
You need to go step by step and show us why anyone reading this would know, having heard the evidence in the case, that this someone had to be Willie Hardiman.
Mr. Leslie Hardiman is en route to meet Mr. Cherry. He has told the police that this is going to be his last transaction with Cherry, the one that's interrupted by the police chase. He's also told them that it's his intention to introduce someone else to Cherry and that there will be no further transactions that he, Leslie, is a party to. So this
That doesn't mean at this moment he's going to do it. Anyhow, go ahead. I understand your point. I think I will be able to explain it to Judge Posner, so go ahead.
I think one of the things that's important to consider here is that this last sentence was not necessary to the government's case against either defendant. All of the information that incriminated Leslie Hardiman was contained in the sentences that preceded this one. And the only purpose for adding this last sentence was to introduce a statement that was inadmissible with respect to Willie Hardiman, but certainly suggested that he was that someone to whom Leslie was referring.
Where is this in your narrative? I'm looking at your statement of facts. Where is this in the narrative? Where is it in the narrative that you show that he made clear, or Cherry made clear, that this someone would be accompanying him and nobody else?
Cherry did not testify. The law enforcement officer's testimony was to the effect that they didn't anticipate the presence of...
Where is this in your narrative?
I'm not quite sure what you're looking for.
Page 9.
In the narrative.
He had obtained 1 kilo of herbs that he attended as someone did the cocaine business and so on. Various phone calls were recorded.
The recorded phone calls followed the arrest of both individuals. Mm-hmm.
So here is where he says he intended to have someone else take over the cocaine business, and you say that's fine. And then he intended to introduce someone else to Cherry, and he'd be dealing with that other individual. How does that specify Willie? I don't get it.
There's no one else to whom he could be referring because there's no one else accompanying him to this meeting.
Referring to someone else. I don't get that. All he's saying is he's intending to introduce some... It's from the juxtaposition of the sentence, it sounds like what he means is he's turning his business over to someone else and he's going to introduce that person to Cherry. Isn't that what it sounds like? So if that's true, then if that preceding sentence is harmless, so is this one. I'm going to turn over my business to someone else, and I'll introduce you to the someone else, right? Well, what's that about? That's about the future. I don't know what that's about the specific transaction.
I believe I'm out of time. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Cook. Mr. Blackington?
Good afternoon. Intended to spend a lot more time talking about the Bruton-Ice confession, but I think the court is certainly aware of the issue given the questions. The question is does this facially implicate Willie Hardiman? And the confession does not facially implicate Willie Hardiman. Is the court found it could implicate Willie Hardiman? It could implicate other people who are not even present at the scene of the traffic stop. The evidence, including the recording conversations from jail, mentioned another person who is involved who is known as Big J. It could have implicated Big J, certainly. As far as the admission of the testimony by Detective Denzel Lewis and the hearsay arguments that Attorney Baldwin raised in behalf of Leslie Hardiman, it's our position, and I've detailed it in the brief, that many of the statements are not even hearsay statements. One is a directive statement to another police officer to execute a traffic stop on a certain vehicle that's being driven by Leslie Hardiman. So it's my view that none of those statements that were introduced were hearsay statements. In any event, there were no objections to the statements, so the plain error standard applies. The severance argument that was raised by the counsel in the briefs, and first they waived the right to argue severance because they didn't renew the motion at the close of testimony as is required. And secondly, in their pretrial motion to sever, the counsel for Leslie Hardiman and Willie Hardiman discussed mutually antagonistic defenses that would surface at trial. Those defenses didn't surface at trial. Leslie Hardiman's...
That can't be decisive, though, right? I mean, what if they had two really good defenses, but because they're antagonistic, they don't want to kill each other off, they decide to withhold them?
Well, the purpose of a joint trial in that type of situation that you described is to favor a joint trial in that situation where there's finger-pointing going on, the underlying theory being let's let them point fingers at each other and let's let the jury figure it out. So in that type of scenario where there are mutually antagonistic defenses like that, a joint trial is favored in that type of
situation.
There was
no suggestion at the pretrial conference that that was what was going to happen, other than the blank statement that there would be antagonistic defenses.
Yes, and I think part of what may have... I don't think that the defense counsel filed any type of bad faith motions and argued before trial that there would be mutually antagonistic defenses, knowing that they wouldn't surface. There was a change
in
Leslie
Hardiman's counsel.
Was
this motion made
before
or after the motion to suppress the... redact the confession or keep the confession out that Leslie gave?
The motion to sever? I think the pretrial motions were filed at the same time.
Simultaneously.
If not simultaneously, very close
in time.
So
they related to each other, you would suggest?
Well, in one respect, they could be. The pretrial motion to sever focused on the existence of mutually antagonistic defenses. But certainly a Bruton problem can also be a basis for severance. And if the court would have ruled that the statement wasn't properly Brutonized before trial, the district court could have then, as a remedy, severed the trial.
Right.
But, you know, here the mutually antagonistic defenses that were, well, we're going to have mutually antagonistic defenses or what's said before trial. That never surfaced during the jury trial, so there really wasn't a basis for the severance motion. And in any event, they didn't re-argue that motion at
well,
the close
of
the
trial. Well, as Judge Posner pointed out, the theory of defense might not have been available to them once the motion to sever was denied.
They never really articulated what the mutually
defenses were. Well, that was what I asked before. Had they articulated what it was, and you said no. But I said, to simply suggest that it didn't service during the trial doesn't really solve the question, which is what Judge Posner said, that it's highly possible that if something would have surfaced, the antagonist would have shown had there been separate trials. But there was none, and nobody told me about what it might be now.
I guess it would have been nice to know before trial what those mutually antagonistic defenses
were.
They
don't have to tell you what the defense is.
My guess is Leslie Hardiman, and my guess is slightly educated. It's articulated in their brief. They may have wished to argue possibly that from Leslie Hardiman's perspective that Willie was the perpetrator of the whole crime and Leslie didn't know what was in the bag. But, not severing the case for trial doesn't preclude Leslie Hardiman from making that defense. And that's why we want joint trials in these situations where there are mutually antagonistic defenses, so we hear it at one time and let the jury sort it out.
Why do you think Willie was acquitted of possession with intent to distribute?
That's always scary when you try to think through it. And
but is there some notion of what what they were.
Anybody talk to the jurors afterwards?
We're not allowed to in our district. There's a rule against it. Anytime anybody asks me what a jury's thinking,
how much cocaine was in the bag that he threw in the woods or whatever?
There were about 55 grams of crack cocaine, if my memory's correct. It was close to about 2 ounces of crack.
That's distribution quantity.
That keep you high for a while.
Yes, and that was the testimony.
But they might be trying to do him a favor, too. You never know.
Sure, but if he's even discarding evidence and covering up a crime, that can be joined her into a conspiracy as well.
I mean, did he present some theory to the jury that, you know, this was for personal consumption or...
He being Willie?
Willie, yeah.
No, there wasn't any defense about personal use.
So it's a mystery.
Yeah.
Most jury verdicts are a mystery.
That's...
Except the ones I tried. They were always clear to me.
That's right. It's not an exact science for sure. I don't have anything else to say unless the court has some questions for me.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Washington. So, Mr. Ballman or Ms. Cook, have you anything further you'd like to say? No? Okay, well, we thank you very much for accepting the appointment. And the court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.